Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive deep into their impact on the world. We'll uncover historical context and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
So Abby, actually, I have an exciting bunny update for you.
Yes, what is it?
I wanted to text you, but then I was like, no, I have to tell you this in person. Mm-hmm. So we were out of town over the weekend. Mm-hmm. And on Friday, I was like, the bunny, she's like starting to build this thing back up that she did when she like had babies for the first time.
Uh-oh.
And so I was like, oh no, is it happening again? And so yeah, we came back and there are four new bunnies. It is so wild. And actually, a lot of people are probably now going to say, why didn't we separate them? But here's the thing. 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, when we first like had the bunnies, I called the vet and I was like, hey, this happened. I need an appointment to get my bunny neutered. Mm-hmm. And they were like, yeah, we can only give you one in like 4 weeks, which was yesterday. So then I was like, should I keep them separated? Because a lot of people suggested that online. But then they said that if you separate them, then maybe you cannot get them like back together because they will not get along.
Right.
So I was like, man, we might have to risk this. So yeah, no. I cannot believe that like 2 months ago we had two bunnies and now there's nine.
Like, there's nine.
It's so wild. But the good thing is that like we already have a home for most of them. So I feel like that's good. We will keep them until they're like old enough, but then they will go on to their own homes.
This is my favorite B plot of this podcast is Emma and the bunnies.
Yeah, mine too. I really love it. But I have to say, for someone who just like wanted to have two bunnies, it's a lot right now. I love them. I think it's the cutest thing. And if we had the space, I would totally have 100 bunnies. They're like so incredibly cute.
And they're so sweet.
They're so sweet. Yeah. And they like want to come over and cuddle and they like hang out all day. But yeah, now we have babies and then
even smaller babies.
We have babies and babies.
That is so funny.
It's wild. But yeah, the other one is neutered now. He needs to stay on his own for a little, for like a day or two, which he doesn't seem to be enjoying that much. But he's doing well. I think everything went well with him.
I'm glad all is well with you and your bunny brood.
It's wild. How have you been?
I've been pretty good. Once again, I am podcasting from a place that is not my place. I'm hanging with my dad's parents for a couple days.
Oh, that's nice.
But people listening will probably think I'm never home because this is the second episode in a row and we post every other week. I was home in between this, to clarify.
It's always good to visit other people.
Yeah. That's how it always goes. Like, you post that you're in some other place and then all your family or all your friends will come out of the woodwork being like, hey, come stay with us for a couple days. Hey, are you busy on this day? That's what summer is.
But I love
it. I love it too. I went to a record store yesterday.
Ooh.
Surprise, surprise. I picked up some hot new albums.
Great.
New to me because they're all over 50 years old, surprise, surprise. And one album that I'm really excited about is a greatest hits by a certain brother-sister duo. Take it away, Emma.
In many ways, today's doll stands for why we wanted to start this podcast. Every now and then, a video of a young girl performing an impressive drum solo while singing Dancing in the Street on the 1968 TV talent show Your All-American College Show surfaces. The comments are always filled with people praising her skills and beauty and asking who she is. It's 18-year-old Karen Carpenter, a woman who had a truly moving life as one half of the Carpenters. Today, we want to share her life story with you. So most of today's episode comes from a book called Lead Sister, The Story of Karen Carpenter by Lucy O'Brien. I just wanted to put this here because that book really dives into a lot of stories and like parts of her life that we couldn't cover because this episode would have been so long. But if you enjoyed the episode and you want to learn more, I can highly recommend you to get that book. It was a great read.
We're both like pretty strong readers on this podcast. We go through a lot of books for the show. Quote, "For a long time, my parents had been waiting for a daughter. Finally, on March 2nd, 1950, my mother gave birth to a girl. That, of course, being me. I was born in Grace New Haven Hospital, located in New Haven, Connecticut. The fun in my life began when I began to talk. I opened my mouth, which never closed since, and said my first words, those being, bye-bye, and stop it." I love that quote.
Yeah.
"Karen was born to Agnes and Harold Carpenter. Harold was the son of a British father and an American mother, but he was actually born in China. His parents went there originally for missionary work, but liked it there and decided to stay. The family was very religious and eventually returned to the States, where Harold eventually met Agnes. The Carpenters, the family, not the family band, were a prime example of a proud, practical, all-American, working-class family. After 10 years of marriage, they had their first child, Richard." Even though this is Karen's story today, it is also Richard's. These two had a strong bond, and neither Karen nor Richard's lives would have been what they were without the other. From an early age, Richard was fascinated by music. He played the piano and became somewhat of a child prodigy. 3.5 years later, Karen arrived. As children, the two siblings were pretty different. Quote, "While Richard was listening to music the whole time, we had a basement and he never left it, I was out playing baseball and football and playing with my machine gun. Very tomboyish."
But Karen, too, had a love for music, which she expressed through dancing. She was a popular girl who quickly made friends in school. To the outside, it looked as if the Carpenters had the perfect life. And in some ways, they truly did. But there was something that Karen struggled a lot with. Her mother bluntly favored her brother. And we will come back to this later. It wasn't like she just had the feeling that her mother liked her brother more. Her mother openly admitted that she loved her brother more than Karen. I feel like this must be so hard on someone. I cannot imagine what it must feel like always coming second in your own home, in your own family, the place and people where you should really feel safe.
Yes, it's so confusing for a child too.
Yeah. As a child, Karen idolized her brother and wanted to do everything that he did. She started testing out different instruments. But Richard was the family prodigy, and despite her enthusiasm for music, Karen's gift wasn't acknowledged. And she was relegated to little sister, following in his shadow. But she was an active listener, absorbing every melody she heard. Later, music critics would write that Karen's smooth vocal style was at odds with the raw rock of her contemporaries, that she was one of a kind. However, the roots for her sound can be traced back for her love of 1930s and 40s radio singers.
In June of 1963, the Carpenters moved to the Los Angeles suburb of Downey. Harold got a job offer from a former business associate, so the whole family relocated. Karen was enrolled in Downey High in 1964 at age 14, making her a year younger than her classmates. By the sounds of it, she would have been placed in the 10th grade, even though she was the age of a 9th grader. This could happen with school transcript stuff and required classes she's already completed back in Connecticut. Karen joined the school's marching band, mainly to avoid gym class. So relatable.
Yeah, I would have been the same. Yeah.
Bruce Gifford, the conductor who'd previously taught Richard, gave her the Glockenspiel, an instrument she wasn't thrilled with. But she saw her friend Frankie Chavez play the drums. He'd been playing from an early age and idolized Buddy Rich. Karen asked Mr. Gifford if she could try the drums instead. She wanted a Ludwig set because it was used by her favorite drummers, Joe Morello and Ringo Starr. Check your Beatle box off your cards, dolls, pod, bingo players. Frankie convinced Karen's parents to buy her a $300 Ludwig kit, which is about $2,900 today, and began to teach her how to play. Karen's enthusiasm for drumming led her to teach herself most of what she needed to know. How to play complicated lines, stick control, different drumming styles, techniques, and grips, like traditional and matched grip. She practiced every day, and within a year, she could play complex time signatures like the 5-4 of Dave Brubeck's Take 5. Karen began to study technique with Bill Douglas, a well-respected jazz drummer who'd played with big band era icons like Benny Goodman and Art Tatum. Soon, Karen got a professional kit. Initially, Karen was nervous about performing in public, but she said, in quotes, was too involved in the music to worry about it. She graduated from Downey High in 1967, receiving the John Philip Sousa Band Award, and enrolled as a music major at Long Beach State College, where she joined the choir with Richard. Karen became more confident in her singing and began taking lessons with Frank Pooler, the choir's director. He worked with her on developing her upper register so she would have a full 3-octave range. She learned a blend of classical and pop repertoire. Pooler later said, quote, "Karen was a born pop singer. By 17, her voice, quote, was a remarkable instrument."
Karen and Richard's first public performance was in a local production of Frank Lerser's musical Guys and Dolls, but many might be surprised to find out that in Karen's first band, she was not playing with her brother. Karen's first band was called 2 Plus 2, and they were an all-girls trio formed with friends from Downey High. They didn't last long because one of the mothers refused to let her daughter go to their first gig. I guess that must have been a little disappointing for them.
Can't really be a band if you can't go to gigs.
In 1965, Karen, Richard, and his college friend, Wes Jacobs, who played bass and tuba, formed the Dick Carpenter Trio. They practiced every day and played jazz in nightclubs. Richard was blown away by Karen's musical talent, saying she could, in quotes, "speedily maneuver the sticks as if she had been born in a drum factory." At that point, Karen didn't sing. Instead, singer Margaret Chaynor would guest on some numbers. The trio signed a contract with RCA Records and recorded 2 instrumentals, but they were never released.
In April of 1966, Karen and Richard were invited to audition at a session with bassist Joe Osborne, a member of the Wrecking Crew. These guys backed everyone in the 60s, from the Ronettes, the Righteous Brothers, Ike and Tina, Sonny and Cher, the Monkees, and the Beach Boys. Other notable members include one of the few female bassists in the biz at the time, Carole Kaye. Such a cool lady.
Yeah.
Karen was supposed to be the drummer, but she tried singing and impressed everyone with her unique voice. Osborne signed her to his label, Magic Lamp Records. He wasn't particularly interested in Richard's development. In 67, Wes left the trio to study at Juilliard, while Karen and Richard were keen to explore other musical styles. They formed the group Spectrum with Gary Sims and John Bettis. Spectrum focused on their vocal harmonies and recorded many demos in Osborne's garage. They experimented with overdubbing voices onto a multi-track tape. This is advanced stuff for a home musician at the time. Technically advanced as they were, the demos were rejected many times by record companies. They struggled to establish a following because their sound was so different from the hard rock and psychedelic rock popular in the clubs. In 68, the Dick Carpenter Trio appeared on Your All-American College Show, performing Martha and the Vandellas Dancing in the Street, with Karen playing the drums and singing. The trio won the finals that year.
Finally, in 1969, A&M Records signed Karen and Richard to a recording contract as Carpenters. Yes, you heard that right, they were never called the Carpenters. They're just called Carpenters. This actually came because they wanted to sound like a band name and not like a last name. But I feel like everyone refers to them as the Carpenters.
Yeah, I think it's just a symptom of that 60s thing where you just referred to any band as the blank.
Yeah.
Cream were called the Cream in the press. The Move were technically just the Move. See, there I go. The Move were technically just Move, but everyone just called them the Move. So it's natural this happened with the Carpenters too.
I actually read that Richard wanted to go by Carpenters because he loved Jefferson Airplane, and it wasn't called the Jefferson Airplane.
Ah,
so that may have been the reason. But I feel like just as you say it, the Carpenters also works way nicer in most sentences. So maybe that's also part of it.
And even then, we nicknamed Jefferson Airplane the Airplane.
Yeah, it kind of goes like this.
Yeah.
Karen started out as both the group's drummer and co-lead singer, originally singing all her vocals from behind the drum set. She sang most of the songs on their first album called Offering, later retitled to Ticket to Ride, And Richard wrote 10 of the album's 13 songs and sang on 5 of them. The opening and concluding tracks were sung by both siblings in unison. I feel like this is the very popular Carpenter sound.
Mm-hmm.
Besides drumming, Karen played bass guitar on 2 songs, All of My Life and Eve, under Joe Osborne's guidance. On All I Can Do, she played in 5/4 time. And Your Wonderful Parade featured multiple snare and bass drum overdubs to emulate the sound of a marching band. The track Fun. Ticket to Ride, a Beatles cover that later became the album's title track, was released as their first single, reaching number 54 on the Billboard Hot 100.
That's really good for a debut single. That's really good.
And I think it is very interesting because the Carpenters had a sound that wasn't heard much during the time.
Mm-hmm.
As said, psychedelic rock was everywhere and their sound is kind of very nostalgic, I'd say. So I think it is interesting that they came on so strong, even in the beginning. Their next album, 1970's Close to You, featured 2 hit singles, They Long to Be, Close to You, and We've Only Just Begun, peaking at number 1 and number 2 respectively on the Hot 100. At this time, they really had made it big. Because Karen was just 5 feet 4 inches tall, it was hard for people in the audience to see her behind her kid. After reviews complained that the group had no focal point in live shows, Richard and manager Shervin Bash persuaded Karen to stand at the microphone to sing the band's hits, while another musician played the drums. Initially, Karen struggled in live performances, singing solo, as she felt more secure behind the drum kit. After the release of Now and Then in 1973, Karen sang more and drummed less, becoming the focal point of all records and live performances. Bash said, in quotes, "She was the one that people watched."
So you just mentioned those 2 hits, Close to You and We've Only Just Begun. How did you first hear the Carpenters?
I was actually thinking about that, and I have to say I don't remember, like, consciously listening to it for the first time. I feel like it's always been a sound that I admire. I was thinking maybe it was in dance, because I used to do like ballet and classic dance, and I have the feeling that this might have come up at one point, but it's just the kind of music that I love to listen to when I want to unwind. This is the kind of music I love to listen to when I read or just daydream. It's just such a wonderful sound, and it is so out of everything else that was heard during this time. What about you?
I think that sort of universal sound is why here in America, the Carpenters are still classic rock radio staples, or even soft rock radio staples, probably. If I were to throw on my local soft rock station, you can't go a day without hearing the Carpenters. I was That's first so nice. Exposed to the Carpenters. It was the song Close to You. And it was in the 2007 Simpsons movie.
That's so random.
I saw it with my dad because, like, the Simpsons are my dad and I's thing. We watched that together when I was a kid.
That's sweet.
And the movie came out. And they played Close to You over this scene where, like, Marge is taping over their wedding video. Like, and Close to You was Homer and Marge's song. Aww. And it was this big emotional scene, but kind of played for laughs because it's still The Simpsons.
I have to be honest here. I've never in my life seen an episode of The Simpsons. I know who they are, but I've never seen it.
And so now I just forever associate Close to You with that movie. And I'm not mad about it.
That's so funny. I feel like we will come back to the significance of these songs, but I feel like they had a special meaning mm-hmm. to Karen too.
In 1974, Karen became known to fans as the lead sister. This originated from a Japanese journalist misspeaking, saying lead sister instead of lead singer. Karen later wore a t-shirt with the nickname during live shows. I love this gimmick. We posted the lead sister shirt as the hint, didn't
and
we?
And some people even got nice. It. Some did, yeah. But I think that this is interesting because from hearing the backstory, you would always think that the leader, if you could say so, of the two was Richard. He just seemed, it seems like it, he did something and Karen just followed along. During this time, she really gained a lot in like the creative process, and she just became a lot more open and vocal about what she wanted for the band.
She was the face of the band.
Yeah.
Starting with the Carpenters' 1976 concert tour and continuing after, she would perform a showcase in which she moved around the stage playing various configurations of drums. Her studio performances benefited from close miking that captured the nuances of her voice well. Though she had a 3-octave range, many of the duo's hits prominently feature the low end of her contralto range, leading to one of her better one-liners, quote, "the money's in the basement." Karen always considered herself a drummer who sang. She preferred Ludwig drums, including the super-sensitive snare. She was a bit of a gearhead, it sounds like. Yeah. Had lots of opinions about production and engineering, because she was... It seems she was really involved in the studio process.
Yeah, and she favored, I read that just from like a visual standpoint, she favored clear drum sets. If you like look back at a lot of the Carpenters' performances, you will see that she had one set that was fully clear, and then the other one was clear but had like a blue iridescent stripe across all the drums.
Cool.
Yeah, these look really fabulous.
Back in 67, Karen released her first solo record, Looking for Love, backed with I'll Be Yours, on the Magic Lamp label. Only 500 copies were made, and the label folded shortly after, making these a hot collector's item.
In the mid-1970s, Richard developed an addiction to Quaaludes. The Carpenters frequently canceled tour dates and stopped touring altogether after the September 4th in 1978 concert at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. In 1980, Karen performed a medley of standards in a duet with Ella Fitzgerald on the Carpenters television program Music, Music, Music. In 1981, after the release of their Made in America album, which turned out to be their last, the Carpenters returned to the stage and went on some promotional tours, including an appearance for the BBC program Nationwide. Now was the last song Karen recorded, in April of 1982. Though Richard was concerned about her health, he still thought her voice sounded as good as ever.
In 1979, Karen started recording a solo album in New York with producer Phil Ramone. The sessions produced music that was different from the usual Carpenters material, leaning more towards disco and up-tempo numbers, with more mature lyrics and taking full advantage of Karen's upper vocal register. Although Ramone never produced an album deemed unworthy of release, the album was met with a tepid response from Richard and A&M execs in early 1980. It was shelved by A&M co-owner Herb Alpert, despite attempts by world-renowned producer Quincy Jones to convince him to release the solo record, after a remix. A&M subsequently charged Karen $400,000 to cover the cost of recording her unreleased album to be paid out of the duo's future royalties. A portion of it was released in 1989, when some of the tracks were remixed by Richard and included on Love Lines, the final album of previously unreleased material from the Carpenters. Not until 1996 was Karen's complete self-titled solo album finally released as originally intended. Rob Horberger wrote in the New York Times that it may not have been the album to define Karen's career, quote, "but it holds up with anything that like-minded singers, Streisand, Newton-John, were recording at the time."
Usually with these episodes, I like to go chronologically and tell the career part and the personal life all at once, but I felt like for this episode, it was better to separate them. See, while one would look at Karen's and Richard's life and think they were perfect, the truth was far from what many would expect. The Carpenters had a squeaky clean image, which differentiated them from most of the popular singers of their time. But behind closed doors and offstage, both siblings were struggling.
We would like to issue a warning here. The next part is going to discuss eating disorders and addiction. If this is something you can't listen to right now, please stay safe and skip ahead, or we will see you in the next episode. Please take care of yourselves.
That's the most important thing. Karen had begun dieting while she was still in high school. As a teenager, she was considered chubby and put on the so-called Stillman diet, as prescribed by her doctor. It's important to say here that this diet is not advised anymore, and it is really unhealthy. The general idea was that one would only eat calorie-less foods and drink 8 glasses of water a day while avoiding fatty foods at all costs. Karen reduced her weight to 120 pounds and maintained that weight until around 1973, when the carpenter's career was at its peak. Just to be clear here, for someone with Karen's height, this is a perfectly healthy weight, but everything below 100 pounds would be considered underweight and dangerous. That year, she saw a concert photo of herself and felt that her clothing made her look heavy. She hired a personal trainer who advised her to change her diet. The new diet built muscle, which made her feel even heavier instead of slimmer. Karen fired the trainer and started her own weight loss program using exercise equipment and counting calories. She lost about 20 pounds and aimed to lose another 5 pounds. Just to keep track here, the 5 pounds would put her 5 pounds below the 100 pound mark. Her eating habits also changed around this time. She would try to remove food from her plate by offering tastes to others with whom she was dining. She once wore a low-cut dress with an open bag, and when Richard saw her, he was shocked. He could count all the bones below her thin skin. He talked her into wearing a cardigan with it, but this was when he became truly alarmed.
Richard was struggling too. In the mid-70s, he developed an addiction to Quaaludes. Richard, who had never taken heavy-duty drugs in his life, was prescribed Quaaludes by his doctor for his insomnia, panic attacks, and depression. Production of Quaaludes was stopped in the 80s. You can't find this stuff today because it was so dangerous. But in the 60s and 70s, it was a heavy sedative often prescribed for insomnia. The primary effect is deep sedation. At lower doses, users might experience a sense of well-being, even diminished anxiety or euphoria. This contributed to their popularity in the 70s as a recreational drug, known as a disco drug. Taking them as Richard did, every day, came with risks. Quaaludes were highly addictive. Regular use could lead to physical and psychological dependence. This is exactly what happened to Richard. In January of 1979, Richard, semi-comatose from Quaaludes, took a fall down a flight of stairs backstage, which finally pushed him to confront his addiction. He checked into a 6-week program at the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, and managed to kick his habit. Since he had an overall successful stay at the clinic, he always encouraged Karen to get help herself.
I feel like this is such a hard conversation to have with someone who is struggling with an eating disorder, because I can just speak from my own experience here. I struggled really bad with anorexia and bulimia in like my later teens going into my 20s, and an eating disorder gives you a sense of control. So for like the longest time, the person struggling with it most likely doesn't see it as a struggle. They just see it as like a coping mechanism or something. But most likely people in the beginning of this doesn't see that it is as bad for them as it is. So when someone came up to them, and this was what happened with Karen and Richard, he would come up to her. He would be like, hey, maybe you want to look into getting help. And she would always say, no, she's fine. She's doing well. And I feel like with most eating disorder, and it was the same for me, it takes something to like push you over the edge. And I have to say, Richard, I feel like, did the best he could in this situation. He really tried so hard to get her help. But in the end, Karen is a grown adult. She can make her own decisions. And he just didn't have the power, or I don't know how to phrase this, but he just couldn't do anything for her. He basically had to sit there and watch his sister go down this. And I feel like this must have been so painful for him, too.
And I also want to identify that it was probably so much easier for him to kick his addiction because he had a stronger support system. His mother and father clearly favored Richard, and Karen throughout her life just didn't have the same support system, which you need to kick something like that.
Yeah, and I feel like I read this multiple times that her parents always were like, oh, well, she's not eating that much. It's fine. It's not that bad. And they weren't alarmed by it in the way that Richard was. And I feel like it came from the fact that Karen also changed a lot in like the way she was, the way she just went on stage, her energy was low. And I feel like her parents, they didn't knew her like that. They didn't know how bad it already had gotten. By September of 1975, Karen weighed 91 pounds. At live performances, fans reacted with gasps to her gaunt appearance, and many wrote to Karen and Richard to ask what was wrong. She refused to publicly acknowledge that she was suffering from an eating disorder, and in a 1981 nationwide TV interview, when asked point blank about anorexia, she simply said she was pooped. This interview is so painful to watch because the interviewer is just pushing her so hard, asking over and over, and you can see how physically uncomfortable she is. And then Richard, he steps in, he's like, I'm not here, or we're not here to talk about this, we're here to talk about the music. But the interviewer keeps going on until she just says, yeah, no, I'm pooped. So I feel like in the 80s, and this is something that will come back later in this story too, there wasn't awareness for eating disorders at all. It was something entirely new. And so I feel like if something like this would have happened now, the public reaction to it, at least I would hope so, that it would be different. But by the mid-1970s, Karen still lived with her parents, who still weren't aware of her talent. I cannot believe this. They have had multiple Billboard 100 charting albums and records and singles, and the parents still are talking her down. Karen had a difficult relationship with her mother, who favored her brother, and she always wanted to prove to her mother how good she was. In 1976, Karen bought two Century City apartments and combined them into one, with the doorbell chiming to the opening notes of We've Only Just Begun. She collected Disney memorabilia and enjoyed playing softball and baseball. As a child, Karen played baseball with the other kids on the street and was often picked before Richard for games. She studied baseball statistics carefully and became a fan of the New York Yankees. In the early 1970s, she became the pitcher on a celebrity all-star softball team. While she was busy with recording and touring, she also made some new celebrity friends, including Petula Clark, Olivia Newton-John, and Dionne Warwick. What I found truly interesting when reading about Karen's life was that while she enjoyed success as a female drummer in a mostly male occupation, her views didn't align with the women's liberation movement. She believed a wife should cook for her husband because men weren't skilled at cooking and planned to do so when she married.
That's so interesting.
She's
kind of one of the boys in so many other aspects. And yeah, it's just interesting.
I feel like maybe this came from her wanting to be so perfect and like her mother, because this was kind of like the Carpenters' upbringing, and the life in her family home was very traditional.
Yes, I was thinking about this too. They, you know, working father, mother who stays home, a son and a daughter, that was the idealized 1950s nuclear family. That was the Carpenters. So I guess it's a little less surprising that Karen would subscribe to this, what we now consider such a rigid belief system. Many believe Karen's marriage was her breaking point, which drove her deeper into her eating disorder. In early interviews, Karen made it clear she wasn't interested in marriage or dating, believing that a relationship wouldn't survive constant touring. She once said, quote, "As long as we're on the road most of the time, I will never marry." By 1976, she mentioned that the music business made it hard to meet people, and she wasn't willing to marry just for the sake of it. Despite this, Karen admitted to Olivia Newton-John that she longed for a happy marriage and family. Later, Karen dated several notable men, including Mike Curb, Tony Danza, Terry Ellis, Tom Baylor, Mark Harmon, Steve Martin, Alan Osmond, and Bill Hudson. After a whirlwind romance, she married real estate developer Thomas James Burris on August 31, 1980, in the Crystal Room of the Beverly Hills Hotel. Burris was 9 years older than Karen and had an 18-year-old son from his previous marriage. A few days before the wedding, Karen recorded a new song, Because We Are in Love, which was played for guests during the ceremony. The song, written by Richard and John Bettis, was released in 1981. The couple settled in Newport Beach, but many of her friends felt like there was something off about Thomas. While he was driving fancy cars and said he owned multiple houses, he often borrowed money from Karen. She knew something was off with him too. She almost called off the wedding. She wanted to have children of her own, but a couple days before the big day, she found out that Thomas had a vasectomy. When confronted about it, he refused to reverse it. Confused and overwhelmed, Karen called Agnes. She wanted to call off the wedding, but her mother pushed her into it, saying all her family had already flown in. I feel like Karen tried over and over again to be close to Agnes, but she never really let her daughter in. So Karen went through with it, knowing she'd never have something she so deeply wanted.
This makes me so sad.
The kids thing wasn't the only thing weighing down Karen and Thomas's marriage. He was living beyond his means, borrowing up to $50,000 at a time from Karen until she was left with only stocks and bonds. He drained the checking account, the savings, and all other investments. Friends of Karen noted that Thomas was also impatient and would lash out at her when he didn't get his way. According to Karen Kamen, this marriage was, quote, the straw that broke the camel's back. It was absolutely the worst thing that could have ever happened to her. She well and truly settled for someone beneath her, I believe.
Yeah.
Truly. In September of 1981, Karen changed her will, leaving her marital home with its art and furniture to Thomas. But everything else, including her $5 to $10 million fortune, was willed to her brother and parents. 2 months later, after an argument after a family dinner, Karen and Thomas separated. Even though she tried her best to keep her struggles to herself, those close to her knew that something was wrong. Dionne Warwick remarked that when they met for lunch in New York in 81, it was shocking to see just how thin Karen had become. You mentioned this earlier about restrictive eating to establish a sense of control. Karen, at this point in her life, she didn't have control over her career, over her money, over her home, over her marriage. So this was the only sense of control she had to fall back on. And it's really sad that she had to resort to that.
When I read this bit about her marriage, I was just so sad because for me it felt like all the people in her life who should have loved her, like her parents and now this man, her husband, just betrayed her so badly. They just weren't there for her. And I just truly hope that one of the men she dated prior to him wasn't this awful. I just don't want to think about the fact that this was the only experience and like only takeaway she had from being in love with someone.
And again, she didn't have the support system that she needed. Her husband treated her like a piggy bank.
I feel like Richard did absolutely everything and he tried over and over. But this is so much to take on as one person. Even though you're siblings and you work together, it's not your sole responsibility to take care of your sibling. Yeah. The entire story is so heartbreaking because it feels like if Karen would have met different people in her life, if there was another set of parents maybe, then all of this wouldn't have happened. In 1981, Karen confided in Richard that she needed help with her problem. Karen reached out to Cherry Boone, who had recovered from anorexia, and contacted Boone's doctor for advice. She was hoping for a quick fix due to her busy schedule with performances and recording, but the doctor explained that treatment could take 1 to 3 years. Karen decided to get treated in New York City by psychotherapist Stephen Levenkron. It is important to note that while Karen refers to him as Dr. Levenkron, he wasn't a doctor. He was a therapist who didn't have a medical license. I just want to add here that the entire idea of getting a quick fix for an eating disorder is just unrealistic. And I feel like that first doctor would have probably helped her so much better, because we will talk about Dr. or not Dr. Levenkron and how he... maybe he tried to help her, but overall, he just wasn't fit for this. And from my own experience, it took me so many years of clinic and therapy to get over this. And I feel like, I just honestly feel so bad for her, because she once again met the wrong person, or like made the wrong decision. I don't know how to say it. I just feel like someone else might have been able to help her more. While it might seem strange that she went with this Dr. Levenkron and you think she could have gone somewhere else for the treatment, it is important to note that in the late 1970s and early 1980s, practically nothing was known about anorexia. It was hard to find someone to treat it, and Karen put all her hope into Levenkron, who had published papers about anorexia and self-harm. But Karen would have also needed medical attention, which Dr. Levenkron, or not doctor, couldn't provide. Describing himself as a, in quote, nurturant, authoritative psychotherapist, Levenkron's approach was quite controversial. His method involved making Karen dependent on him to override the authority of her illness, guiding her like a father figure through the process until she could establish her own identity.
That's so unhealthy.
Yeah, while reading this book, I couldn't decide whether this man was just after her money, because we will get to the insane amount of money she gave him, or whether he truly believed he could have helped her. And I just hope that he at least believed he was doing something for her. Karen's family was skeptical, thinking she might have been better off with a Beverly Hills doctor. But since that hadn't worked, Karen was open to trying something more radical. So basically, this refers to the fact that Karen had seen some medical professionals in Beverly Hills, but they explained to her that it would take a long time, and she just felt like they weren't the right fit for her, which I do understand. You need a therapist that you feel like works for you, but still, I don't know. I just cannot stop thinking about what might have happened if she would have gone to an actual medical center to get a treatment.
Maybe if she had this therapist along with a proper medical treatment program, along with a nutritionist who could have helped introduce those fear foods back into Karen's diet, maybe that would have worked. But again, this is just one facet of the treatment. She didn't have the whole package.
So in January of 1982, Karen flew to New York and moved into a two-bedroom suite at the City Regency Hotel near Central Park, bringing along 22 suitcases of matching clothes and shoes. Karen Ichiuji, also known as singer Karen Ramone, referred to as Ichi by Karen, stayed in the second bedroom to provide support and companionship. I feel like even though her husband was shitty, her therapist was shitty, her parents were shitty, she had some great friends. At least that was something. Karen invested heavily in this treatment. The suite cost $6,000 a month, not including food and phone bills. She also paid Levenkron $100 per session, totaling $2,000 a month. Her willingness to spend both time and money showed her initial commitment to the therapy.
I can't even begin to think of what this would be adjusted for inflation. That's five-figure bills every month, easily.
Yeah. And I mean, Karen had the resources. Yeah. She was unbelievably rich for the time. And I feel like, I don't know, as said, the entire idea of her going there and getting help is so great, but this is something that happened to me too. You have this moment, you're like, oh, I want to get help, but then you will fall off the wagon. It just, I think it is very normal in eating disorder recovery, and you need someone to catch the signals, because eating disorders are very secretive things, so you will lie to absolutely everyone. It's what I did. And I feel like Levenkron didn't catch the signals and signs of how she was actually doing.
And we'll get into this just about now.
Yeah.
Although Karen was determined to beat anorexia in theory, she was undermining her treatment in subtle ways. Instead of taking a limousine to Levenkron's office 19 blocks away, she would power walk there to burn calories. After having a breakfast of bacon, eggs, and toast with Itchy, Karen would use laxatives to purge. Even in her suite, she found it hard to relax, constantly moving around to lose weight. Levenkron was used to dealing with resistant patients and quickly clocked her restlessness and frequent bathroom trips. Her compulsive behaviors were deeply ingrained, so he knew it would take some time to unlearn them. During one early session, Karen admitted to taking over 90 Dulcolax at once. That's just about a full bottle, if I'm not mistaken.
There was a time where she reportedly took a bottle a day. This is like one thing I feel like people don't understand when dealing with eating disorder, the toll that it takes on your body in general. And if you do this on top, your body will not sustain it.
and she also revealed she was using thyroid meds to speed up her metabolism. Levenkron was horrified, as overdosing on thyroid medication would lead to serious health issues. He confiscated the bottle and locked it in his desk drawer. Over the next 3 months, Karen worked with Levenkron to identify how anorexia became her coping mechanism. He observed that she wasn't used to having her needs met and was uncomfortable with receiving care. During one pivotal session, he told her she needed to accept his care before any progress could be made. Karen initially resisted, saying, quote, "I don't need any care. I'm successful at this." Levenkron responded, "But you do need care because you're incompetent, because you can't keep yourself alive." This was a turning point for Karen. She realized how skilled she was at nurturing others, but she was unable to care for herself right now. Then she stopped taking the laxatives. Karen kept in touch with her family by phone, and halfway through her treatment, visited for 2 weeks. Despite her therapy, friends were worried because Karen still looked emaciated and hadn't gained much weight. However, she seemed determined, discussing a recovery schedule and believing she could overcome her illness and meet her recording commitments. During this visit, she demoed new songs with Richard at A&M Studio D, including the song Now. Though her voice was a bit nasally and off-key, the emotional openness in her delivery suggested marked growth and a new self-awareness.
I feel like this is the point that you talked about earlier, that you don't only need a therapist in this situation, but a medical professional too. In this case, as said, I can only go off of my experience in having an eating disorder in 2020-21. And when I went to the clinic, they have you weigh in every, I don't know, couple of days, but they will not tell you how much you weigh, which I mean, is pretty good. And they will monitor how much you eat. And I feel like this entire thing wasn't met there. It just wasn't met. He didn't take care of her blood work. He had no idea in which condition her body was.
Well, he couldn't take care of her blood work because he wasn't a doctor.
Yeah, and that's like the entire gist of it, basically. She would have needed a medical professional there too, and maybe his talking therapy. I mean, this is still a big part of eating disorder recovery, and maybe he was good at that. I don't want to judge about it, but it just seems like he took her on as a client, maybe knowing, maybe not, that he wasn't fit to meet what she needed. Because, and this is like the thing that makes me feel icky about it, he later wrote a book about her and treating like a celebrity patient. And he, till this day, he's still alive, he talks about it.
Doctor-patient confidentiality, man.
Yeah, and that's kind of like the part where I think maybe he took her on because he thought it was a great promo for him, because it would make him a therapist in demand, but he just wasn't fit for this. Several months into his sessions with Karen, Levenkron began to suspect that she had fallen off the wagon. He invited the Carpenter's parents and Richard to a 90-minute family therapy session at his office. In quotes, "They did come to New York, finally," Itchy Ramon recalls. In quotes, and only after a lot of nudging. By then, Karen seemed to be starting to turn the corner a bit emotionally. The stigma surrounding mental illness and a need for therapy was frightening for the family, especially Agnes, who felt Karen was simply going overboard as far as dieting was concerned. If only she would have stopped being so stubborn and just eat. Over the years, the family tried every possible approach to get through to her and make her eat. In quotes, "Everyone around her did everything that they could have humanly done," Richard said in 1993. In quotes, "I tried everything, the heart-to-heart, the cajole, the holler. It can just make you crazy. Obviously, it wasn't about to work, and I was upset." Levenkron explained that the family's attempt to threaten or bribe Karen out of her behaviors would never make them go away. According to his book, which he wrote about this, in quote, "Failure of the family to understand produces division within the family that in turns result in feeling of anger and guilt. The family atmosphere is chaotic, reinforcing the anorexic's belief that she and no one else knows what is best for her." Which I can understand. Like, from being in this situation, yeah, I thought everyone else was overreacting and I was totally fine. Levenkron suggested to the family that Karen was in need of a more tactile, demonstrative kind of love. Karen cried uncontrollably during the meeting. She told them how sorry she was for having to put them in a situation where they felt a need to defend her upbringing, and she went so far as to apologize for ruining their lives. In the end, this is how her parents made her feel. This is not her fault. In quotes, "I think Karen really needs to hear that you love her," Levenkron told the family. "Well, of course I love you," Richard told her unreservedly. Agnes, the therapist, tapped the mother's shoes with his own. Rather than address her daughter, Agnes explained how she preferred to be called Mrs. Carpenter. In quotes, "Well, I'm from the North," she continued, "and we just don't do things that way." "Agnes couldn't do it," says Itchy Ramon, who discussed the meeting with Karen and Levenkron after the family left. "She couldn't do it. In therapy, you're basically stark naked. Then your own mother can't reach out to you." And the way she doted on Richard, most children would try to dance as fast as they could to make their parents love them. But it was that point that I think Karen decided it was time to take a step back.
I am stuck on "I'm from the North, we don't do things that way." As an old school, lifelong New Englander who came from a family of old school New Englanders, that's true. We don't really talk feelings. We're not very openly emotional. I am the exception to the rule. It's just not customary here. Southerners think we're all mean because of it. It's like the stiff British upper lip. It's kind of like that. By summer of 1982, Karen seemed to be making progress in understanding her condition mentally, but her compulsive behaviors were still entrenched and she wasn't gaining weight. Concerned, Itchy called Levenkron, noting Karen was losing energy and getting thinner. Levenkron decided to try a more confrontational approach. He had Karen wear a bikini and look at her emaciated body in front of a mirror. Karen didn't see anything wrong and even thought she was gaining weight. This might suggest body dysmorphia. She physically could not see what everyone around her was seeing.
Yeah.
By autumn, Karen was nearing collapse. When she reported feeling her heart beating funny, heart palpitations, getting dizzy, probably low blood pressure, Levenkron arranged for immediate medical attention. While this man took so much money from her without providing any medical care, he did at least see the signs of severe dehydration. On September 20th, Karen was admitted to Lenox Hill Hospital in New York, weighing just 77 pounds. She was treated for severe dehydration and critically low potassium levels. Her digestive system was so damaged, she needed a feeding tube. That's what happens when you abuse laxatives.
Yeah.
Although she had resisted gaining weight, Karen accepted the doctor's care at the hospital. Over the next 7 weeks, she gained 20 pounds from intravenous nutrition and small meals. She also signed her divorce papers from her hospital room on October 28th, marking her statement of independence from Thomas. That was a very good thing she did for herself.
Yeah, and I feel like the fact that she gained 20 pounds in the short time in the hospital, it just shows that there were different ways to approach this and that they could have her gain the weight and be there with therapy while doing that. I feel like Levenkron cared about her mental health, which is great, but at the point that she was at with being so severely underweight and having so many like physical issues, she would have needed a physical doctor too. Karen discharged herself from the hospital on November 8th, determined to meet her own goal of being well by Thanksgiving. She returned to the Regency Hotel with a personal nurse and strict instructions not to power walk to Levenkron's office. After 2 weeks, she felt bored and homesick, declared she was cured, and had her parents fly her back to Los Angeles. During her last therapy session on November 16th, she gave Levenkron a needlepoint canvas that she had made, which read, "You win, I gain." It was her way of signaling that she believed she had achieved her goal. Levenkron, however, warned her that treatment would take at least 3 years, but she brushed off his concerns, promising to stay in touch by phone. Karen returned to Downey for Thanksgiving, weighing just over 100 pounds. She ate heartily and updated Itchy about her progress. Karen returned to California in November of 1982, determined to revive her career, finalize her divorce, and start a new album with Richard. On December 17th of 1982, she performed for the last time, singing Christmas carols for her godchildren, their classmates and friends at the Buckley School in Sherman Oaks. Her final public appearance was on January 11th in 1983, at a Grammy Awards 25th anniversary gathering. She appeared somewhat frail and tired, but according to Warwick, was still vibrant and outgoing, even joking, in quotes, "Look at me, I've got an ass." Karen also began writing songs for the first time after returning to California, and told Diane that she felt she had, in quotes, "a lot of living left to do."
January 1983, Karen appeared to be back on track, seen in public, shopping, and socializing. She told Herb Alpert she couldn't wait to get back into the studio and start performing again. On January 14th, she met with Richard and their friend Dennis Heath, but she looked stricken halfway through dinner and excused herself to go to the ladies' room. When she returned, she said she was fine. The three went to A&M Studios to listen to the playback of tracks recorded last April. On January 27th, Karen's housekeeper, Florine Ellie, found Karen groggy and barely awake on the floor of her closet. When Florine asked how she felt, she replied saying she was just a little tired. Florine helped her to bed and continued cleaning. Karen seemed to improve, but Florine grew worried and checked on her the next morning. On February 1st, Karen dined with Richard and stage producer Joe Layton at Scandia to discuss a tour. Richard said that Karen seemed to be doing better and how excited she was to tour again. Sadly, this would be the last time Richard would ever see his sister.
The next day, Karen drove to her attorney Werner Wolfen's office to review her divorce papers, setting an appointment to sign them on February 4th at 3 p.m. Karen was enthusiastic about her plan and even talked to Itchy, who was about to give birth, about coming to New York to be there for her. After everything that Itchy had done for Karen, she wanted to support her friend and care for her. On February 3rd, Karen drove from Century City to Downey to buy a new washer-dryer. Unable to find one that day, she stayed at her parents' house and went out for dinner at Big Boy, where she had a shrimp salad and later a taco. On the morning of February 4th, Karen awoke, made coffee, and then went back upstairs to get dressed. So apparently, Karen made the cup of coffee, the pot of coffee, and then went upstairs knowing that it would take about 15 minutes for the coffee to get done. And apparently this was something that she did regularly, and she would just come back down and get her drink. But on this day she didn't, and so Agnes was very alarmed and she went upstairs to check because she was downstairs and they had like a built-in house telephone. So she called upstairs, but no one picked up.
Like an intercom?
Yes.
Okay.
But Karen didn't pick up the intercom, and then she went to the foot of the stairwell and just screamed upwards and tried to catch Karen, but she didn't reply, and Agnes found this really, really alarming because Karen usually was always there for her mom, wanting to make her proud. Finally, Agnes went upstairs to check on her daughter. She found Karen motionless and unclothed on the wardrobe floor. Her eyes were motionless and rolled back. In quotes, "It was like she just laid down on the floor and that was it," Agnes recalled. She called for help, and by the time Karen was admitted to Downey Community Hospital at 9:23 a.m., she was in full cardiac arrest. Despite efforts to revive her, Karen was pronounced dead at 9:51 a.m.
The autopsy, released on March 11th, ruled out a drug overdose as the cause of Karen's death. It attributed her death to, quote, "emitting cardiotoxicity due to or as a consequence of anorexia nervosa." This was kind of a big deal in the 80s. Cause of death wasn't really attributed to an eating disorder yet.
Yeah.
So when this hit the media, this was a pretty big deal. Her blood sugar level at the time was over 10 times the normal level. The coroner later suggested that her heart failure resulted from repeated use of Ipecac, a common over-the-counter emetic used to induce vomiting. However, Levenkron disputed the claim, saying he had never observed her using Ipecac or seen signs of vomiting. We already learned that he wasn't skilled to treat her, and him now arguing with the proven autopsy report is just the icing on top of the cake, really.
It is so wild. Like, this man having the audacity after the death of his client, who, I mean, yeah, if her family would have wanted, I'm sure they may be able to sue him. Like, this mm-hmm. is clearly in correlation with his treatment plan. And now, instead of just being happy that he doesn't get sued and sad that Karen died, he's starting to argue with proven facts of an actual medical professional.
Karen's friends believed she relied heavily on laxatives and thyroid medication to keep her weight down, a problem they thought worsened after her marriage troubles began. Karen's funeral took place on February 8, 1983, at Downey United Methodist Church. About 1,000 people attended, including Dionne Warwick, Dorothy Hamill, Olivia Newton-John, and Petula Clark. Thomas Burris, her estranged husband, placed his wedding band in her casket. Karen was originally buried at Forest Lawn Memorial Park in Cypress, California. But in 2003, her remains, along with her parents, were moved to a private mausoleum at Pierce Brothers Valley Oaks Memorial Park in Westlake Village, California.
Her death came shocking and was mourned by fans all over the world. But the one person who seemed to be affected by it the most was her brother, Richard. He was so close with his sister, and I feel like in many ways he's the hero of this story. He encouraged his sister mm-hmm. over and over again to get help. He so desperately wanted her to get better, and he wanted her to feel loved by her parents. When reading the biography, I wondered whether Richard felt guilty about the fact that his mother favored him over Karen, and I feel like in a lot of ways he wanted to make up for it, which the fact that he was even put in this situation breaks my heart. Mm-hmm. Karen's death brought anorexia into the spotlight, and many have speculated why she suffered from it. From my understanding and personal experience, most people who develop an eating disorder do it out of a loss of control. The eating disorder and controlling of what you eat, how much you eat, and when you eat, the overbearing control over your body becomes a safety net. It's not like people who struggle with anorexia want to be thin for just wanting to be thin. At one point, Karen even got so thin that she would wear multiple sweaters for people not to see her actual body. Eating disorders are mental illnesses that come with a lot of guilt and shame around it, and I feel so sorry for her having to go through that. When I went through my own struggles with anorexia and bulimia, I was lucky enough to have good doctors and a good hospital to recover. I was in therapy for years and closely monitored. I feel like if this would have been possible for Karen, she maybe would have made it out. She seemed so strong and so willing to beat her anorexia, but after all, eating disorders are some of the most deadly disorders out there. Most people struggling with it will never fully recover, and those who fall deeply into it sadly often pass away young. Karen was such a bright light, and it is sad that we will never know what she would have went on to do in life.
How old was Karen when she passed?
31. I think she just turned 31.
The 30s and 40s is about when your body starts to break down if you've had suffered from disordered eating from, you know, 10, 15 years as Karen had at that point. That's about when your heart starts to fail or your digestive system just breaks down completely. Mm-hmm. Dying of eating disorder related causes is such an ugly way to go.
Yeah.
And I don't wish that on anybody.
No, because it also seems so preventable. Mm-hmm. And when I was hospitalized, I had a lot of physical issues too, from all the throwing up. My entire esophagus was like, there was so much acid in it that it was like severely damaged, and my teeth and everything, and the entire digestive system. And I feel like this truly is not only an ugly way to go, but it seems so preventable. But when you're so deep in it, you don't see a way out. And I feel like nowadays medicine and like therapists are way more aware of that. Mm-hmm. Because when I went in, the therapist bluntly told me that the way that I am so deep in it now, she said that I had a 90% chance of dying within the next 5 years if I don't make the decision and stick to changing my life right now. Mm-hmm. And that really shocked me and spoke to me. And I feel like Karen, maybe just...
It scared you straight.
Yeah, it really did. And of course I had like some relapses and it wasn't like a straight way out, but it really made me strong in my will to recover. And I feel like maybe Karen didn't know how bad she was actually doing. The fact that she said, well, my heart is beating funny, it just makes me feel that maybe she didn't read the signs correctly, that she felt like she wasn't doing as bad. And I feel like a common misconception that you have when you yourself are so deep in an eating disorder, and that is what I told myself over and over again, you always think you could stop tomorrow. You always think it isn't that hard. But once you're so deep into it, there's no way. You just will not stop tomorrow.
Since this episode was so sad, we wanted to end with some happier notes and give some recognition that Karen deserves. It's remarkable how she, as a female drummer, revolutionized the music industry. In 1975, Playboy magazine readers voted her the best rock drummer, beating John Bonham of Led Zeppelin. I love that for her.
Me too.
As I mentioned earlier, her material with the Carpenters is beloved to this day, a staple of soft rock radio. And in a 1994, a covers album of all the Carpenters' greatest hits was released. I don't know if you've heard it. It's called If I Were a Carpenter. The Cranberries did Close to You. Sheryl Crow did Solitaire. Even Babes in Toyland contributed to this thing. Oddball as it is, my personal favorite of the bunch is Sonic Youth's take on Superstar. Because of course.
Yeah, it's fitting.
Let's end this episode with some words Richard dedicated to Karen when the Carpenter's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame was unveiled on October 12th, 1983.
This is a sad, but at the same time, a very special and beautiful day to my family and me. My only regret is that Karen is not physically here to share it with us, but I know that she is very much alive in our minds and in our hearts.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. And I want to extend my personal thanks to you, Emma, for writing this beautiful episode and revealing such a personal part of your life story to me, to the listeners, to the whole of your online audience. You are so inspiring, and I'm just so happy.
You're so sweet.
And I'm happy that you're still with us today to enjoy life and your family, your beautiful family. I'm just so proud of you.
Thank you so much. It really means a lot. I was unsure whether I wanted to make this episode because it is so close to me, but when I read this book earlier this year, it just resonated so deeply with me that it really made me feel safe in my decision to share about this. And so I want to thank you for listening. That really means a lot.
We hope you enjoyed our journey. You, listeners, enjoyed our journey through the life of the incredible Karen Carpenter.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. The button is somewhere around here. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.